In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Oh, yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Time to find out what's going on at the movie theaters. Alan Adams joins us for Pass the Popcorn. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thank you. A good Monday to you.
And to you as well.
What's happening in Adams Land?
Oh, you know, living the dream.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, no, things are good. You know, had a lovely weekend. You know, went and had lunch with my in-laws yesterday,
nice.
Which was very nice. It was nice to see them. My mother-in-law had been under the weather for a while, so we hadn't seen them for a bit.
No.
So it was nice to get out and see them and hang out a little bit. But stayed pretty close to home for the most part, which was kind of nice.
We were chatting during the break. I did see the pictures that Stella got to go to work with Sheridan last week. That was a pretty special day.
Yeah, like I was telling you, she had had a really rough night Thursday night. Because of the wind really sort of riles her up. And so she didn't sleep. We didn't really sleep. In the morning when I took her out to, you know, for her morning constitutional, the necessary business was not attended to. We didn't really know what to do because it's like, well, we can't leave her home for, you know,
right.
8 hours having not. And so Sheridan was finally, you know what, like, let's just bring her. Stella had never done a full day at the office before. But she handled it like a champ. Like she really did a pretty good job. Got a little barky in a couple of spots, and at one point was extremely adamant about participating in a meeting. Sheridan tried to like put her in her office. Like they had there's a gate. Like it wasn't like the door was closed, but Sheridan was just like, nope, Stella was not feeling that at all. And so she was allowed into the meeting where she basically just hung out under the table. And just wanted to, she just likes to be where the action is.
Well, sure.
You know? And don't we all?
Yeah, I understand. And you know, most meetings, I would just soon be under the table.
Right. for the most part, you know, you're going to get just as much valuable information crashed out underneath the table as you are, you know, blankly staring into the middle distance.
Is that right?
Which is what I tend to do in meetings and whatnot.
All right, let's talk movies. A couple to get to this week. Where should we begin?
I don't know. Do we want to lead off with what order do we want to go in?
Let's go with Shakespeare first.
Do you want to go good bad or bad good? We'll go good bad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of Shakespeare, obviously.
Yes, I've noted that.
I'm also a big fan of Shakespearean adaptations. I really enjoy when we get a well-executed sort of a different perspective on one of these classical Shakespeare pieces. I feel like there's still a lot of space to say some things using these stories as a framework, even today. Granted, it doesn't always work. Just like with anything, like sometimes sometimes you get a hit, sometimes you swing and miss. I will concede the movie we're going to talk about here, this movie Rosalind. As soon as I heard about it, I'm like, oh well, okay. I'm very much intrigued by this. So for those who are unfamiliar, in Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, Romeo and Juliet meet at the Capulet ball, and you know it's this love at first sight kind of thing. But people don't always remember that, he was talking about another girl before all that happened. And that was the fair Rosalind. And this movie is basically Romeo and Juliet from Rosalind's perspective.
Oh, I like it.
It's got this wonderful sort of, it's period set. But it's very much leans into anachronism. Like the language is more or less modern, and the attitudes, in a lot of ways, certainly from Rosalind's perspective, are modern. And that doesn't always work, but when it does, man, it hits hard. And this movie works. It is it's really funny. It's really smart. It's thoughtful. It's provocative in the right ways. Clearly has a deep an abiding affection and respect for the source material while also being unafraid to tell its own story. Mm-hmm. Like, you put all those pieces together, some phenomenal performances, including just an absolute knockout from Caitlin Dever as the titular Rosalind. It's just a delight. Like, it's just a pure delight. I was always going to like it, but again, it's one of those movies where it's like, I was not prepared for how much I liked this movie. So the basic gist is, you have, Rosalind, living in Verona. She is the last daughter, yet to be married off, by her father, a minor nobleman named Adrian, played by Bradley Whitford, who's awesome.
I love it.
She's, seeing a steady parade of suitors, that has slowed to a trickle because she has basically driven off all of them, with her unwomanly attitudes, like wanting to read books and do things, which is, you know, that sort of inserting any sort of progressive feminist ideology into a Shakespearean sort of framework, that always kills for me. Like, I always enjoy that. It's particularly well executed here. And her only like companion is her nurse. She has a nurse. A nurse who is adamant about being an actual nurse, educated and whatnot, played marvelously by the wonderful Minnie Driver.
Oh man,
yeah, just a great cast. And so she's, she's dealing with all this stuff, but she has a secret. She's involved in a secret tryst, an affair of sorts, with a young man, of whom her family does not approve. A young fella by the name of Romeo Montague, played by Kyle Allen. And here's the thing. The reason that her family doesn't approve is, well, her family has been in a blood feud with his family for many, many years. See, because everyone knows that Juliet's a Capulet. Not everybody knows that that Rosalind, also a Capulet.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, Romeo comes to her window at night, and speaks sweet words of poetry that she immediately calls him out for having previously memorized. He's a nice guy, maybe a little self-absorbed, maybe a little too into how good he looks. Tiniest bit dim, our Romeo. But she's in love. And she wants nothing more than to run away with him. But what she wants to, have a chance to like be with him, like in the public, like out and about. And so, she invites him to her uncle's masquerade ball because they're wearing masks. So everything's fine. She's very excited to go to the ball, but then her father springs on her. Well, I've got another suitor for you. It's a young man, a soldier by the name of Dario, who has been it's played by Sean Teal, and he's not as wealthy as some of these other suitors, not as titled or anything like that, but at least he's age appropriate, good looking kid and whatever. Resentfully, Rosalind agrees to go on a sort of outing with him ahead of the ball. Dario's like, let's go on my sailboat. They go on the sailboat, and storm brews comes up, and they wind up getting delayed. She tells him that she has a boyfriend. He, being a good dude, is just like, oh well, why didn't you just say that in the first place? And they try to head back to shore, but they're bound by the storm.
But not a tempest.
Not a tempest. No, sir. But she gets back to shore and she makes it back to the ball, but it's over. And as we discover soon afterwards, well, she sees Romeo approaching, but not her window. The window of another. She goes, she sees, she's like, what's this all about? It's the next day when we learn that her uncle brings her cousin, over to her house to so they could, you know, they haven't seen each other for many years. And wouldn't you know it, her cousin, who she hasn't seen since she was just knee-high to a grasshopper, has grown into a lovely young woman by the name of Juliet. Isabel Merced plays the part. Her dad, Lord Capulet, played by Christopher McDonald, in precisely the way you want Christopher McDonald to play Lord Capulet, I might add. They put them together, and Rosalind decides, well, I'm going to get my man back. Hijinks ensue. Meanwhile, Dario is there, still there in the background on the periphery. But Rosalind wants so badly to get back with Romeo. But as things progress, she starts to wonder, well, is it really Romeo that she wants? Or is there something else that she's seeking? She winds up hopelessly intertwined in the plans of Romeo and Juliet. I'm not going to go into the plans. If you're not aware what happens in Romeo and Juliet, I don't know, read a book. So we see as that sort of as that dynamic kind of plays out again through the eyes of Rosalind. It's so much fun, man. Like, I had such a good time. Like, the performances are all great. Like I mentioned so many, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention the absolutely spectacular take on Paris that they give us with a young man by the name of Spencer Stevenson. I'm not going to tell you how it goes. Just as soon as I heard him referred to by name, I'm like, oh, this is good. it's just filled with these wonderful performances of people. They're all very talented actors, all extremely capable of delivering this particular story, but also very obviously invested in the broader sort of source material. And when you have that kind of, you know, connection and commitment, like, what you get is something that's just really compelling to watch. It's very fun. It's frothy. A lot of big laughs. It's a little bit more thoughtful than you might anticipate. The absurdity and the anachronisms, they really work. It's just a really, really good time, and I can't recommend this highly enough, man. Rosalind, it's currently streaming on Hulu.
Excellent. Well, that sounds great. I got to check that out. All right, from there to the end, or is it, of the Halloween franchise?
Oh, God, I hope it is, man, because David Gordon Green did his absolute best to just kill it and bury it. This is not a good movie, Rich. And it's a real bummer because, Halloween is one of those sort of beloved franchises, even though, maybe half the movies are actually any good, maybe half, it's funny. And it was one of the things that I sort of thought about as I was working on the review, this idea that it's weird to think about because of the state of the cinematic landscape now. But it wasn't that long ago when, making sequels was kind of gauche. Like, it was like, right. It was one of those things where it was just like, it was seen as like, you know, the sort of cash grabby kind of like, you know, discount racket blockbuster kind of vibe where it was just like, you know, it was just like horror movies and knockoff action flicks like that. Those were the movies that got sequels, your odd, like, you know, Godfather or whatever, notwithstanding that hardly counts. So it's interesting to see how things have progressed here in the 21st century. But, with Halloween in particular, it was kind of egregious because the original 1978, directed by John Carpenter, just an absolute stone classic of the genre, like one of the best horror movies ever made, basically like invented the slasher genre.
Yeah, changed the game for horror.
Yes,
movies.
Absolutely. Carpenter's a brilliant filmmaker. When you have someone with that kind of talent tackling genre, this is what you get. But then, you know, Halloween 2, not a bad movie. Like, it's good for what it is, but it is very much, you know, just sort of standard, you know, bog standard genre fare. And then things go south real fast. You've got the infamous Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, which has nothing to do with any of it. it falls victim to, and we talked about this a little bit last week with Hellraiser. When you have these franchises sort of building on each other, they develop, you know, they feel this need to, you know, to come up with more why. Like, why is this happening? What is, what's the, you know, and so you have this lore that gets convoluted and self-contradictory, and it just gets, turns into this big, tangled mess of narrative that's impossible to untie for anyone who's trying to access, you know, these movies. And so you basically go through, I think, half a dozen of those. There's a gap. Then we had an effort to sort of reboot the franchise back in the late 90s, early aughts. Halloween, I believe it's H2O, it was called. It was 20 years after the original, followed by Halloween Resurrection. So there were, that was a twofer. Jamie Lee Curtis was back for those films, which was nice, but they didn't really work. A few years after that, Rob Zombie took it on. He made a couple of Halloween movies that were basically, you know, basically remakes, only, you know, zombified, as it were. And then another gap, and then we have this current sort of sequel trilogy from David Gordon Green and Danny McBride, where they basically scrapped everything except the first movie and just sort of like went straight to, which is a smart thing to do, like clean the slate. Like that's the move. And 2018's Halloween is a good movie. Like, it's a good movie. Like, I really thought it was good, because, you know, it's very much a sequel, and it's this wonderful look at sort of this idea of the sort of trauma that would come in the aftermath of being a survivor of something like this. Mm-hmm. It was treated with a degree of verisimilitude that I don't think you necessarily see in those sorts of movies. And again, it's Michael Myers. It's this, you know, 6-foot-6 dude in coveralls with a knife and an inside out Shatner mask who can't be killed. So, you know, take the realism with a grain of salt. But so that one was good. Halloween Kills, which came out last year, was okay. Like, it wasn't great, but at least it was trying to do something. And then we get to Halloween Ends, and this is all just a long way of saying that that Halloween Ends is not the payoff that we were hoping it would be. Instead, what we get is a movie that bears relatively little connection to what came before it. Like, I mean, it's set 4 years after the events of the previous one, and we have we're introduced to a couple of different characters. You know, Laurie Strode has moved into town and is writing her memoir, which is fine. I mean, people move forward, I guess. But then about halfway through this movie, we get just an absolutely absurd turn of events that drastically alters not only the rest of the movie, but kind of retroactively messes with what came before. Yeah. And you hate it when that happens. Yeah. You know, like, it's just you've made a bad choice, and that bad choice reverberates not just forward but backward. And I'm not going to spoil it. I should, honestly, because that might preclude some of you from actually watching this movie, because I can't stress enough how disappointed I was in the experience. But plot, such as it is, we start in 2019. We're in Haddonfield, Illinois, obviously. We meet this kid named Corey, who he's a bright young kid, bright future, wants to be an engineer, getting some extra cash, doing some babysitting on Halloween night. Tragic circumstances, accident happens, and our friend Corey winds up as a bit of a pariah in the town of Haddonfield. His bright engineering future is gone. He winds up working at his dad's junkyard, and is generally just viewed as damaged goods by the people of Haddonfield. He sort of becomes a de facto replacement for the now missing Michael Myers, missing and presumed dead, but again, no body. So I think we all know how that's going to play out. So he's getting harassed. One day he's getting harassed by some hostile teenagers who, by the way, I'm not going to name their names because, I shouldn't be mean to kids, but some of the worst, teen acting I've seen in a long time. Like, they're reprehensible, like, characters, but like just the way in which those characters are presented, just bad stuff. Like just like, I don't know, go back, stay in school, kids. Like I don't know what else to say. Anyway, so he's being harassed by these kids. Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis comes to his rescue. He's injured, so she takes him to the hospital. The hospital where it just so happens her granddaughter works. Her granddaughter who lives with her after the events of the previous film. Obviously, Corey, Allison, there's an instant connection. They're bonded by the weird looks that townspeople give them. It's unclear. Much like a lot of things in this movie, it's unclear. Their relationship starts to burgeon, and then all of a sudden, Laurie Strode's like, "Wait, well, maybe I don't want my granddaughter to hang out with this guy," and so that turns into a whole complicated thing. And then about halfway through, well, Michael Myers shows up and does some stuff that drastically alters what happened previously, what's happening going forward. I'm not going to spoil it, but we'll leave it at this. In this particular film, there's more than one person doing some killing.
No,
we'll put it that way. There's a lot of killing going on, and I'll just leave it at that. Like I could go on, I guess, but the truth is, it's like. We go through, and there is a very distinct ending. Like it ends.
Yeah.
They're definitely throwing dirt on the grave by the end of this movie. But it's just, man, it's just such a cruddy way to go out. You know, I feel bad for a lot of people involved in this movie. Honestly, the person I feel the worst for is Jamie Lee Curtis. Man, like if you're a legit horror fan, like you've been hanging out with Laurie Strode for like 50 years at this point.
Yeah.
You know, like that first movie came out in 1978. Like that's a long time ago. She's been like that character has been part of the canon for such a long time. And to go out with a whimper like this, it just sucks. You know, and it's just unfortunate. And it just feels like the first two movies felt like they were building to something. I can't believe this is what they were building towards. I have to feel like something got lost in translation. Something happened along the way. I don't know what, but for whatever reason, it just didn't click. It did not come together in the way. Well, I guess I was going to say it did not come together in the way that it was expected to. The truth is I can't figure out what someone would expect. Like that's the thing. I don't know how you could possibly think that this was gonna work, but here we are. And again, I can't stress this enough. None of this is Jamie Lee Curtis's fault. Like she's going for it. Like she, like Laurie Strode, that is a character that she has absolutely embodied on so many occasions. She continues to do that here. The script doesn't do her any favors, but she goes for it in the best kind of way. And then there are other people in this movie. Like that's kind of the deal. You just don't care about anybody.
Right.
Like, and they're like these ostensibly a romantic relationship where there's zero chemistry. And, I mentioned the terrible teenagers and, you know, you've got some townspeople kicking around like, well, Will Patton's in this movie. It's like, oh, nice to see Will Patton getting a check. But, he's like, but it all feels so perfunctory, like so phoned in. And for this to be like, they're billing it like this is it. Like we're done with Halloween. Obviously you're never done with anything in Hollywood,
right?
But I will say, considering how this one turned out, I think it's going to be a good long time before any executive does enough cocaine to be like, you know what we should do? Let's make another Halloween movie.
Yeah.
I feel like that well has been kind of poisoned. So, yes, Halloween ends, it definitely ends.
Wow. I like that description.
I give it 5 years tops.
it's one of those things, at least maybe it'll cleanse the palate. Like it just, I mean, I think it boils down to, I was going to say it boils down to how successful this movie is, but the truth is, like, it did $40 million at the box office despite being available on streaming.
Wow.
Like, I watched it at home. Like, yeah. I watched it on Peacock, but it was in theaters, and it did very good business. So you're probably right, Carrie, because, you know, quality is important. Sure, but nothing beats the almighty dollar there in Hollywood.
Ain't that the truth? Hey, before we let you go on a couple of minutes, if you would like to talk about the production from the University of Maine's School of Performing Arts.
Oh yeah, I'd love to. The UMaine Theater Department their current show is it's a show called Melancholy Play by Sarah Rule. She's a wonderful playwright, probably best known by people who know these sorts of things as the author of Eurydice, which is a great show. This is a wonderful piece. It's this great sort of abstract, kind of surreal, deconstruction of the nature of romance and, and what it means to be sad. You know, the idea that that a variety of emotion is important. You've got a young lady who is basically set upon by a fit of melancholy, and that melancholy draws people to her. Whether you're talking about a vaguely European psychotherapist or an accountant turned tailor, a physicist turned hairdresser, and her nurse companion, all these people kind of drawn into orbit around this young woman named Tilly. And then things get weird when the melancholy becomes so overpowering that, someone may or may not turn into an almond.
I'm sorry?
Someone may or may not turn into an almond.
Wow.
Yes. It's, like I said, it's a real trip. The production design is phenomenal. Scenic design by Dan Bilodeau, lighting design by MJ Sedlock. It's directed by UMaine Professor Rosalie Purvis, and it's going for one more weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, at Hauck Auditorium on the UMaine campus. We've talked about this on a number of occasions. I am a fierce advocate for academic theater. I think the sort of work that is being done on college campuses is work that you can't see anywhere else. The experience level might not be what you see in other places, but I feel like that is more than made up for by the pure passion of the participants, the joie de vivre that is just evident when you watch a group of young kids. I say young kids, you know, they're college students. Everybody's a young kid to me at this point. they're just very they're very passionate about what they're doing. It's a very talented group that they've got on campus right now. A lot of really wonderful, talented actors. It's the kind of show you're just not going to see anywhere else. And so if you have the opportunity, I believe Friday and Saturday night, the shows are at 7:30. There's a matinee at 2, I believe, on Sunday. And if you have an opportunity to get out there and check it out, I highly recommend it. It's just, it's wonderful work being done by a group of very talented and very eager students who are just doing their best to do something that they've put together a hell of a show. And I really hope that that people get out there to see it. Like, we saw it opening night in front of a pretty full house. It was raucous, very funny, very poignant, and just a good time at the theater. And what else you doing on a Friday night?
There you go. Awesome. Thanks, Al.
Hey, my pleasure.
Alan Adams talking movies and a little bonus theater talk with us.